it's really, I think, a very important thing to get out of your own, what you think you have to do or should do. And like you said, the ego, drop that at the door and start to really focus on where you can have the most success and where your customer is.
You're listening to the Elevate Podcast, and I'm your host, Robert Glazer. Join me as I talk to world-class performers about how they build their capacity and reach greater heights in leadership, business, and life, and how you can do the same. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. Our quote for today is from Estee Lauder: "I never dreamed about success, I worked for it." My guest today, Kendra Scott, is one of the rare entrepreneurs who's become a household name. She's the founder and executive chairwoman of the fashion empire Kendra Scott, which she has grown from a small startup to a billion-dollar brand with over 3,000 employees and 120 stores. Kendra won the EY Entrepreneur of the Year Award in 2017, was inducted into the Texas Business Hall of Fame in 2019, and has been featured on the hit show Shark Tank. She's also a dedicated philanthropist on the board of directors of the Breast Cancer Research Foundation and founder of the Kendra Scott Women's Entrepreneurial Leadership Institute at UT Austin. And Kendra is also the best-selling author of the memoir Born to Shine that published in 2022. Kendra, welcome. It's great to have you on the Elevate Podcast.
Robert, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me. I sound pretty cool with that intro. Wow. I was like, whoo.
Sorry, I had to set high expectations. Well, thank you. I know it's taken us a while to get this together, but I saw you speak a few years ago and excited to ask you some questions here. So I always think it's interesting to start with childhood. And in particular, I want to ask you about your stepfather. He discussed having a really big impact on your life and purpose. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I was really lucky to have this person in my life as a bonus dad who was a two-tour Vietnam veteran. He spoke 5 languages fluently. He had the greatest tan you've ever seen in your life, a magnetic smile, just a gregarious person. And he was diagnosed with brain cancer when I was 15 years old. And, you know, my life at that moment took a very pivotal change. This person that I adored and loved so much was really fighting for his life. Someone that I thought that, you know, he was so strong and nothing could get this guy down. And this cancer really got to him. And during that time, I was spending a lot of time at MD Anderson, meeting so many men and women undergoing chemotherapy and cancer treatment. And I had loved fashion and design since I was a little girl. And so I started creating headwear options that were comfortable. I would sew cotton linings in hats and bring them and gift them to some of the women that I would meet while I was, you know, up there at MD Anderson. And it really, you know, he, you know, during that time said, "Kendra, you have such a short time on this earth, honey. And I want you to use the gifts that you were given to make a positive impact on this world." And what I was doing with this hats, it really was doing that. I was using the gift of design, which I had to be able to help people. And I really had this philosophy of wanting to be able to continue that. So that was the goal with my first business, was a little hat business that I had starting at 19 years old. And I lost him, when I was actually 20. And my little hat store was failing. And so I had to close that business. But it just stuck with me that I wanted to be able, if I did have the courage to do something again, I wanted to do something that was going to be able to make a positive impact on the world. He died when he was 47 years old. On my 47th birthday, I had to step away from the table and I just sobbed in the bathroom because I thought, I get another day tomorrow. I get another day hopefully next year. And I have to make every day count. And it really, he's been my North Star in when I founded Kendra Scott and our philosophy of wanting to create a fashion for philanthropy brand. And without him in my life, I don't know if we've been able to do the things that we've done today.
So that was the hat box, right?
Yep, the hat box.
So you dropped out of college to start that business.
I did. Well, the goal, Robert, was I was going to go back. Okay. Like I tried to convince my parents and myself that I'm going to go back. I'm just going to take a little break. I'm going to start this new business. But unfortunately, you know, things changed. Not unfortunately, fortunately, life took over and my life had a different path. I had that business for 5 years. And I really looked at it, you know, when I had to close it, it was the hardest time in my life. And I went and I had to get a job, but I had a side hustle. I was making jewelry in my hat store and customers were calling me not for the hats, but for the jewelry after I closed it. And so I started making and designing still jewelry while I was working in this corporate America job. And I realized that the hat box was my MBA. I mean, I learned everything about business, everything I did right, and the multiple millions of things I did wrong. And I was able to take all of those incredible on the job training, you know, really learning it myself, these golden nuggets, and put them in my pocket. And I had those with me when I founded Kendra Scott, and I would not have the successful brand and company I have today if I didn't have that Hatbox store and that business that failed.
I mean, your story is so similar to others I've heard in just that respect, with the failure and the learning and all the things I'm going to do differently this side. I'm curious on your take. You know, it just seems like this achievement culture today, we are just encouraging young people in the forward not to get anything wrong and not to make any mistakes. And then the real world hits up eventually and they realize it doesn't work that way. Like, what are your thoughts on this? And how do we make it okay to fail and learn? And because as you kind of rose from the ashes of the Hatbox to start Kendra Scott.
If we don't allow ourselves the ability to misstep or have a failure, we are never going to move forward in our lives. On the other side of fear, it's very scary sometimes to open those doors, to take risks, to take a challenge. And I keep going back to what I just said. Our time here is very short. So we've got to be able to go through. And you know what? This is life. There are things in life that work out great the way you planned, but most of the time, okay, whether that's, you know, people who get married, who maybe they realize, oh God, I thought this was forever. It's not, right? So I think it's so important that we really think about how we are going to be able to position ourselves to say when those things happen, and they will happen. So instead of going, I don't want it to happen, I have to do everything to prevent it from happening. Yes, of course you don't want to fail. But you will, okay? There's going to be some times in your life that you're going to fall down. You're going to scrape your knees. We have two options. We pick ourselves up, we dust ourselves off, and we go, what did I just learn in that moment? And how am I going to be able to take this thing that just happened that didn't feel good, that isn't what I had planned, and be able to keep it with me? Because when the opportunity arises, and it will arise if you're looking for it, I'm going to be able to know something that I wouldn't have known before that is going to allow me to be successful in the next thing that I do, whether that's in your personal life, your professional life, your business life, whatever that looks like, right? So I think we've got to, one, also be loving and kind to people when they do go through those moments. After I, you know, ended the Hatbox, I was so humiliated, Robert. I was so ashamed of myself. I felt like the biggest loser on the planet. The person I had started this business for, I had lost to cancer. I was now a college dropout with no degree. I mean, all my friends had degrees. They were going to these big jobs. I literally felt like the lowest person that you could ever imagine. And so when I started to think about doing the jewelry as a full-time job and really trying to start another business, I didn't want to tell anybody because I didn't want people to laugh at me, to say, ah-ha-ha, here she goes again, good luck. Oh yeah, she's the one with the failed hat store. You know, she's, oh my God. Because I thought this is what was going on. And what I realized is I was making these voices up in my own head, what I thought the perception was. This was my internal voice telling me that I wasn't good enough, that I shouldn't do this again, that I'm going to fail again. It wasn't the world saying these things. It was my own voices that I was projecting on the world. So if we can get out of our own heads, that's the biggest thing, right? We have to get out of our own heads and say, you know what? I am courageous. I am brave. And I am not afraid to fail. I am not afraid. And I'm not going to let you or you or you or the voice in my head tell me any different.
Well, I first heard your story in this program called EMP that we were both in. And I'd love for you to tell it from the lens of that program, because I just thought it was fascinating. EMP is a program within the entrepreneurs organizations where people basically commit to go to school for 3 years. And it's for people who really want to scale and grow their company. And then the classes stay together. And then if someone did a case study on it, the business growth that has come out of this program is extraordinary. So you came back, you know, as the sort of example to talk to our class. This is like a picture in a picture, telling the story about being in the back of that same room in your class and someone saying, a $1 billion business is coming out of this room, going to come out of this room. And you almost walked out of the room because you felt like you were in the wrong room. So can you tell the story about how you started Kendra Scott, where you were when you walked in that room, and then kind of what happened after that room? Because I love that story.
So I founded Kendra Scott in 2002, and I was a strictly wholesale business. So just designing, manufacturing, and selling to other retailers. Because after the hat box failed, I was like, I will never be in retail again. That was scary stuff. Like, I am not doing that again. But I felt like I needed this business brand. I was trying to read books and learn what I could. And I joined an organization called Entrepreneurs Organization so that I could start to meet other entrepreneurs. I was like in this period where I just wanted to be a sponge and try to learn as much as I could from people that I admire and respect. And I was encouraged to apply for this program at MIT. And I thought, there's no way I'm getting into this program. I mean, it's people from around the world. It's not just people in the United States. And I think maybe they had a quota for women or something. I don't know. I got in. All right. I'm going to be honest. I got in, and I'm sitting in this room with 64 other entrepreneurs, and I took a seat in the very back. I did not want to be noticed. I don't belong with this group. These people are way at a different level than me.
And just for context, how big was the business at the time?
Oh, like 2 million in sales. So not big, not big. I mean, big, but not like big compared to like zero sales, right? But like not at the levels of most of these people in this room, okay? And they, you know, they went around, and first our guy, Brian, he said, okay, one of you is sitting in a $1 billion seat. And I'm like looking around the room, and I'm like, yeah, it's got to be either that guy from India or this guy over here. You know, I'm trying to think of like who is it going to be? Definitely was not even remotely considering that I could be sitting in the $1 billion seat. And they would go, we went through and we introduced ourselves. I don't remember, you know, everyone goes through and they tell like, I'm a Stanford MBA, I'm Harvard, blah, blah, blah. And I'm here I am. And I'm hearing all these like resumes, and I built this business and blah, blah. And they're all just like puffing up and like telling their, you know, big guys on campus. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm dreading having to be the one who has to stand up and say, hi, my name is Kendra Scott. I'm a college dropout. I'm a single mom to two little boys. You know, I was horrified. And I was like, you know what, Kendra, I'm just going to be honest. And I said, I stood up and I said exactly that. I said, I was very intimidated to be in this room, and that I'm really hopeful that I can help my business and my vulnerability. I teared up during talking, and it led to everyone in the class all of a sudden starting to feel that they could be vulnerable. And they started sharing their fears in their business, what they were scared of, why they wanted to be part of this program. And all of a sudden, those walls of like, ooh, I've got to be this, was like, just let's be honest and real. And I just thought it was a beautiful moment for our class. And they embraced me. They all stood up and applauded me after I spoke. Which was the opposite of what I thought, that I thought they probably are going to laugh me out of here. And they didn't. And, you know, that class is still, those friends in that class, we graduated in 2009. And if you look at Kendra Scott, the business, when we had lightning in a bottle growth was 2009 and beyond. That class gave me so many tools and the ability to learn how to have the entrepreneurial mindset and the business acumen to run a successful company. And I'm so grateful that I had that opportunity.
Part of the story was you started the business, right, with your son in tow and a baby Bjorn going door to door, right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, he was 3 months old, and I started going, yeah, store to store with my jewelry in a tea box, because I didn't even have a proper jewelry case, Robert. So I literally, you know, when I had him in my little baby carrier, and I'd go into these boutiques and be like, hi, I'm Kendra Scott. Would you like to look at my jewelry? And I say all the time, I'm so happy I started this business in Texas. Southerner, you know, Texans are very friendly. And so it's like these store owners would be like, oh, honey, come here. I'll hold the baby. You know, like so nice. Whereas
in the Northeast, you would not have had the same reaction. Yeah,
exactly. But, you know, I think it's a good sales tool, actually. Bring a puppy or a baby and it might get you a way in. But I literally started with, you know, out of my extra bedroom, just create, you know, making the pieces on a card table that my mom had brought over. And then, you know, getting to where I was getting more stores interested in the line and having to get an office, and then realizing like, hey, maybe I have a real business here, instead of it just being kind of a thing where I thought, well, I could make some money for my family. it was like I had to get back into, Kendra, you can start another business. You can do this. And it took other people believing in me, buying the products, for me to start to believe in myself.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to up your game? 2 years ago, I bought a dual suspension mountain bike for the first time, and it pushed me to ride trails that I had never been willing to try before. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has exceptional capability that will have you seeing the possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. The Lexus GX comes with available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, best-in-class towing capacity, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. I've seen the new Lexus GX popping up all around my town, and not only does it have the capabilities to take you to new places on and off the road, but it's a great-looking car. The new Lexus GX is ready to raise the bar for you. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. With everyone fighting for attention these days, how can you get your business to stand out and connect with customers? It's easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media postings, and even event management. You'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track your growth. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence, knowing that your emails are actually reaching your customers, thanks to their best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. Constant Contact was actually the first email marketing platform I ever used almost 20 years ago, and it's a testament to the product's quality that it's still the standard for email marketing today. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Look, so jewelry is an industry where there's a ton of competition, both from massive brands and small local businesses. So, like, looking back at your success in the meteoric rise there, what do you think helped made you stand out and grow in what is a crowded marketplace? Because I'm always amazed, particularly in jewelry, when this, you know, a brand pops up and the differentiation's hard, but you did something really well there.
Thank you. You know, I looked at what I wanted, right? And I think, you know, you hear this so often from entrepreneurs that have been successful is something that they can't find and they solve a solution for it. There are usually other people that feel the same way. And that was exactly where I was at. I wanted high quality, beautiful, semi-precious. I loved colored stones, but I couldn't afford what was out there. And the only other option was really inexpensive, you know, using inexpensive materials or lucite or plastics or acrylics. And I wanted to be able to make an affordable jewelry line with beautiful quality materials that was attainable for women. So earrings, $100 or less. That wasn't inexpensive, but it was attainable. Somebody could figure out how to afford that. And so that was one. So there was white space between fashion jewelry, costume jewelry, and what we call bridge jewelry. There was this really great white space that could kind of bridge in between there that I saw was open. The second thing is everybody was using the same materials, all the same shapes. No one was identifiable. You couldn't look at one jewelry brand versus another and know what the brand was, especially in this category. You could in higher end, like David Yurman, he had some recognizable features to his jewelry that would say, oh, that's a David Yurman, right? But I wasn't seeing that anywhere else. And I knew for me, I knew stone shape and stone material was something I was like so passionate about. And if I could create unique methods of how I would show our materials in unique shapes that I could copyright and I could own those shape designs, that would be something that could get people to recognize.
You were able to copyright the shapes?
Yes. So every single shape that we use at Kendra Scott today is custom made and designed here in our lab and then sent to our stone cutters, and we copyright those shapes. So now all of our shapes are that way. But in the early days, I didn't have enough production to do that. So I just had to try to build this, you know, business of going direct to the vendors instead of using wholesalers and importers and exporters. I went direct to the stone sources so that I could cut some of those middlemen out to be able to offer a better price point to my customer base. And then as I grew production, I was able to, and it took many years to be able to do my first stone cut, which is still our most popular shape to this day. It was called the Danielle. It's now the little Lisa necklace that we sell one of those every minute, by the way, which is crazy.
It's crazy.
But that was my first stone shape, and that became a recognizable shape. And that was one of the things that helped for our tipping point. If you guys have read the tipping point, it was our crown jewel, right? It was our thing that was like, okay, that is her. And it started to put a name with the brand and the products.
So you've talked a lot about like imposter syndrome, and I assume in leading a fast growing company, you also talked about not having formal business training, but again, you are the exception. Like very few founders can take the company to the size that, that you have. Usually there's three or four leaders in that time span. And I think to do that fundamentally, just from my experience, I've done a couple of those turns, but I stopped far before your level. You have to kind of reinvent yourself over and over and become a completely different leader. So like, how did you go from solopreneur to scale up CEO to managing a multi-hundred million dollar business?
So a couple parts to that. One, I think that there are so many things of my, the startup Kendra Scott leader is still relevant for me today. I'm scrappy. I roll my sleeves up. I get right there in with my team. I'll be in the warehouse shipping product. I'll be on the sales floor selling, you know, in our stores with our team. I love that part of it. And I think that is so important for so many leaders to hear because they shouldn't change those fundamental things about leadership in those startup years. You're doing so many things right. The other part is that I couldn't afford people early on. And I really had to start to identify, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? What things should I be outsourcing? I am not great at finance and accounting. I'm not, okay? Me doing spreadsheets, I'm wasting hours of my time during a day doing something that just is not my wheelhouse. I'm great at the design. I'm great at the marketing. I'm great at how everything is going to look and feel and all of those things, right? I need people that are great at the things that I suck at, whether that's hiring them internally or getting them externally through, you know, outsourcing. So I think that's one of the critical things of how you can scale is so many leaders try to think they can do it all and they end up doing everything pretty badly. So the best thing, I mean, I don't know if you've read it, but Marcus Buckingham's Now Discover Your Strengths. I love that book and I love Marcus. It really helped me identify those things. And so start to building a team around me that we could all focus on what we were great at. And we all had an aligned vision. We knew exactly what our goals were, where we were going, and together, not me, together we built the roadmap to get us there. It was a collaborative effort and an aligned vision. And then when you put all those things together, you can have lightning in a bottle growth like we had, an incredible synergy. And so no one can do this by themselves. And I think, you know, I'm always learning, Robert. I wake up every single day and I'm running a company bigger than it was the night before. I mean, just think about that for a minute. And so I have to have great mentors, advisors, people on my board that have walked in these shoes in other businesses and other companies that I can lean on and say, hey, what are your thoughts about this? What do you think we should look at when we're looking at this next opportunity? I know that you've gone through X, Y, or Z. I love your input. If you were in my shoes today, you know, when you went through this, what you would have done differently, what you would have, you know, whatever. And I think you have to be able to ask for help. You have to be able to be vulnerable and you have to be able to understand that you will never know everything. And the only way to do that is to bring people around you that truly are smarter and brighter in those areas that can help you achieve the success that you're looking to do.
Well, I want to pull two things of what you said there, because I think one is important and probably is a big answer to the question. And that is you quit a lot of those other jobs early on. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs just hold on to them and try to do everything and micromanage and make the business all about them. So it sounds like you settled very comfortably into the things and probably the creative and marketing genius that's kind of your zone of genius. The other thing is you said an aligned vision. I'm sure one of the things you took out of the EMP program was the vivid visioning. So could you talk about that? And can you also share about sketching the headquarter building? Because I remember you sharing that story.
Yeah, exactly. No, I actually, so in my book, Born to Shine, Cameron Harold, who came in and talked to us about vivid vision, I actually worked with Cameron to have this included in my book because it is such a big part of my success and the company's success and my personal happiness is really being able to look at a 3-year plan. Like Cameron says, anything beyond 3 years, we can't figure out, right? These 10-year goals are ridiculous, right? So 3-year plan, what is your business? What is your life? What is your family? You have to put it all together because your business is a portion of your life. It is not your whole life. So if you can vision out exactly how you want things to work and run and operate in your whole life, you can start to live in that person.
And your business can destroy your family for a lot of people.
So for me, part of it was I was a mom first. And before I'm a CEO, before I'm a designer, I'm a mother. And I wanted to create a company and a business that allowed myself and the other parents in this company to be able to be there for their families first. And that was part of my vision of what will that look like? How can we create that? And then putting out in the world the big, hairy, audacious goal, the BHAG, right, was I was going to put something so crazy. I could be a $1 billion brand and a household name. It was laughable even for me writing that down on paper. Like it seems so silly to even put that down on paper. But once I put it down and the other folks on my team saw the BHAG, they started to believe in it. And if you can see it, you can believe it, right? And you started to think, okay, we'd do our 3-year and then we'd make this goal. And it was like all of a sudden we started stair-stepping to this $1 billion dream. And it got there a whole lot quicker. I mean, I never even thought it would be possible to say that, right? But it really is. So it's such an important exercise and something I think every single person in a company or starting a company should absolutely do.
And for those who don't know BHAG, it's Big, Hairy, Audacious Goal, which is the crazy, that came from Jim Collins' book, What is the Crazy Thing That Your Business is Going to Achieve? So on the flip side, you had this BHAG. I know you started the business in 2002. About 6 years into it, we hit the Great Recession. I have to assume that's an existential threat for a lot of companies. How did you navigate through that? And did you think there was a good chance that you wouldn't make it through to the other side?
So it was really great because I was in EMP in that program at MIT during the Great Recession. So, it was the last year, really was 2006 to 2009 was our last year. 2008, the world was already starting to show signs of a decline in our economy. By 2009, so many members of my class, their businesses had failed. Our class was getting smaller by the minute. And so we started with 65. We did not end with 65 people that had survived even at that point in 2009. And I was just a wholesale business because remember, Robert, I was too afraid to get into retail again. I said no to that. I was like, no way, Jose, I am not doing this. And that changed, right?
Right. Sometimes our failures, the scars heal, but the wounds are deep.
The wound was deep. Okay. It was really deep. And I was like growing, but not growing fast. I was doing well. I was able to pay my rent. I was able to keep my kids in school, like doing those types of things. But I wasn't growing by leaps and bounds. I was very conservative. I was very risk averse. And when the recession hit, so many of my stores that I had worked with for years were shuttering. So many of the buyers at the big department stores that I had built relationships were getting laid off. And many of these businesses wanted to start going just direct and doing private label on their own. And I was just like, oh my God, all of my eggs are in this basket. I have 100% have allowed the power of the pen to be in the hands of these store owners and these buyers. And I have been not focusing on what was most important, which was my customer. I did not have a direct connection to my end consumer. I did not have a wholesale. I did not have a website, an e-commerce website. Everything was wholesale. I did not have my own retail stores. I had no way of communicating with her directly. And I knew that if I was going to survive this recession, I had to change my business model. So that moment, I like to call them, I call them in my book, a shake the snow globe moment. The recession was a shake the snow globe moment for me. And it forced me to have to do my business differently. And I went to my team and I said, look, we are not going to survive this if we don't change our business model. I know this is crazy.
Because your customers were probably going under, right?
Yes, every day, every day. I mean, we had shipped orders where companies had filed bankruptcy and we never saw the money for those orders. I mean, it was crazy. So I said, look, if you guys are with me, it was kind of like the Alamo story for us Texans. We know this one, but it was like,
right, we're about to run into the burning building as everyone's running out of it.
And there's like a line in the sand. It's like, those of you who are with me to cross over the line and go into the burning building, raise your hand. If you don't, I get it. And I basically said, we're going to change our model. We're going to go direct to consumer. We're going to still have our wholesale business, but our entire focus and energy is going to be to connect to our customer directly. Because if she wants and loves the brand, she's going to yell for it in her other retail stores she goes to. So she is going to get our power back. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to open a retail store when everyone is closing them in Austin.
Well, the good news is real estate was probably cheap.
It was great. You know, we're going to start an e-commerce website. Like, we're going to do this. And I basically, at that point, I had no investors in my business. I did it on what I had left in our line of credit. I did it on credit card debt. And we just made a huge shift. And we actually moved our office to above the new store. So we would all be there to be able to work the store and also learn from our customer. We'd have to walk through the store to get to our little desks upstairs. And it was our laboratory. We were learning everything about our business, our customer, what she loved, what she hated, what she wanted more of. And we saw this incredible response and our business blew up from 2010 to today. I mean, it has just been, and that was this pivotal move. And we grew the business we have today out of one of the scariest financial crises in our country has ever seen. And so that just kind of goes to prove to all of us is that sometimes we get so in our own, like it has to be this way, that we're not seeing things from a 360 perspective until your snow globe gets shook. And then you're like, oh boy, we got to do something different.
But it's also better for you to shake the snow globe than a lot of times for someone else to shake the snow globe, right?
And I wish I would have shook the snow globe 3 years earlier, right? I mean, we could have grown even faster then, but I was too afraid to do it. And I think our fear is, like we talked about earlier, can get in the way of our success. And so how we push through that, having these examples now of the recession, when I feel scared, now I kind of get excited because I'm like, okay, that feeling.
This could be big. Yeah.
This could be big, but I had to experience it to know it.
Hey, Elevate listeners, whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify is the partner you need to keep the cash register ringing for your e-commerce business. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading platforms. I advise a lot of companies in the e-commerce space, and almost all of them have migrated to Shopify. And as a buyer, what I love about buying from Shopify-enabled sites is that they already know who I am, and I don't have to create a new account or enter all my payment info. The ShopPay service makes it faster and easier to buy, which surely helps with conversions. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/elevate. All lowercase. Go to shopify.com/elevate now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/elevate.
Well, you mentioned investors, and I know you struggled to get investors. I'm sure, again, it's better now, but it was probably mostly men. They didn't understand this, how it was different. At the end of the day, probably allowed you to hold on to majority of the business. So many people, you know, the world and the 37 Signals Basecamp guys have talked about, there's just so much around this culture of Silicon Valley and getting investment. I'm sure it sucked at the time, but looking back, it was probably a blessing in disguise.
No, I mean, look, I'm still majority shareholder. shareholder of my company, and people, you know, can't even get over this, right? But it was not a choice, Robert. Okay. I would walk into these boardrooms in Austin, and it was very much a tech town back in, you know, 2003, 2004. Like, fashion in Austin was not something anybody was thinking about. Jewelry, and, you know, I'd walk in, it didn't matter that I had Nordstrom and I had some of these big name, you know, customers. These guys would look at me like I had three heads. Like, wait, you're not doing a software or a tech company? We're like, what? Like, I don't understand. And I'd be like, no, but I've got this great business and this is what we're doing. And I mean, I would get like laughed out of these boardrooms. And it was so hard because I just remember going to my EO friends and saying like, what do I do? I need to get investment. They're like, Kendra, you need an angel. And I'm like, yeah, I know that I definitely, like, where do these angels hang out? And you have to remember, we weren't in a time when we had all this connection. Like, I don't even know if I had Facebook back then, or if that was even a thing till like 2005 or six. We didn't have the access to people and hearing about investment funds for women. That just wasn't something we had access to.
So they also didn't exist, as much, right?
No. So I just, you know, I remember I brought an advisory board because I didn't have a typical board and I wanted to have the discipline to have quarterly board meetings. I wanted to have people, you know, look at what I was doing and be critical of things I should be doing differently that had experience in areas that I didn't. So somebody, you know, whether that was in, you know, web development and some of the things I needed as we were building out our retail stores, real estate development. And I literally remember one of my mentors saying, Kendra, if you build it, these investors will come. And keep your head down and build the best business you can build. And I know that's hard to say. And I know you have everything you own for collateral right now on loans. And I know you're signing personal guarantees on these leases. And I know you're stressed. But I promise you what you're doing, it will bring investors. It just took me 10 years to get the phone to ring. But then when it started ringing, it wouldn't stop ringing. And it was then, okay, how am I going to bring in the right partner? And at that point, money became easier to get. It was, what strategically can I bring in the right partner who, again, has that aligned vision, that shares my core values, that sees what I'm trying to do, that will allow me to be able to grow this to the next place. And that was an exciting point. So in 2013, I sold 20% of the company with about $110 million valuation. That was the first time in my life I had any money I was living my life on a float.
Right. When you're growing that fast, and people don't realize this, it's like doubling down at the casino. You have to keep more inventory. It just, then the money doesn't come out.
No. I mean, and I, you know, I hired a COO who I couldn't afford. I mean, I remember my controller saying, Kendra, you can't afford this person. And I said, I can't not afford him. And I'll pay myself like nothing, you know, like barely enough to just pay my basic bills so we can get him. But it was those types of decisions that helped us get to the point we are. And it is so exciting now to be able to still be in this control space. You know, 3 years later, we brought in another investor. The company was then valued at $1.1 billion after 3 years. So that investor that came in at 20% at 110, they were very happy. But it was exciting because I was able to still maintain control. And that was so important for me. My name's on this brand and I care so much about this. This is like my other child, you know, is this company.
I realized I asked the question before and then we skipped it, but can you just tell the story about drawing the headquarters?
Yeah, I literally, you know, drew this image of like what it would be. And I had it, you know, like it was going to have a fitness center and a kid's playroom and like a nail salon. And like, I drew this big dream of like, what would my Google be? You know, the Kendra Scott Google, and drew it out. And I remember when we moved into our first, like in the headquarters, and I brought all of this things to the table of like how I wanted to design our office, how I wanted it to be this really work-friendly environment for moms with nursing rooms for all of our working moms who had babies and all these crazy things. And then to see it coming up, and I actually was driving and they were putting the name Kendra Scott on a building, like a big building. And they had like the Kendra and the SCO, like I think it was Kendra Sco was up and they were about to put the TT up. And I'm at the stoplight and I'm watching this crane and I just start bawling. And people are honking at me, Robert. Like, I'm supposed to be turning left. I'm stopped, like literally froze, and just tears streaming down my face. And I was like, holy cow, this is real. Like, this was such a far-fetched dream. This was so far away. It was just like playful to think that this could ever happen. And to see it happening, it was such a moment of, it is, if you dream it, it can happen. And I never thought it would. And it was definitely one of those pivotal, like, you had took your breath away moments of like, wow, okay, this is real.
How many years from that initial sketch that you had in that notebook to the building being built was it?
8 years.
8 years.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
And those 8 years really went by so quickly, but also just, I mean, again, like, it just never seemed like that would ever be a possible thing. It was just more of like a fun, playful thing to do.
So you alluded to some of the values before, and I know your company's core values are family, fashion, and philanthropy. I'm curious, are those your personal core values and well, and how did you kind of decide on those for the business?
I think when you're a founder of a business, it's you're the first DNA of what that brand is going to be. And so what matters to you? What are the things in your life that are so critically important to you? Because when you can form a healthy, happy culture is when birds of a feather flock together. And the way that you can create that is by sharing your core values. You have different, expertise in various things, but the heart, this is the heart of your soul, of your brand, and of who you are. For me, being a mother and being a present mother while starting this business was critically important. I wanted to create a family-first environment in my company. I wanted to be allowed to be a mother and not be ridiculed for being a mother. And I wanted others in my organization to have that same feeling that we had a village of support for one another. I wanted to treat my employees like my sisters and my brothers, and I wanted them to treat me the same. I wanted to treat our customers that way. So this family value was everything to me. When you walked in our stores, how you were greeted, like you would be in my home, you know, all of those things went around this family value. The second was fashion and design. I wanted to make products that made people feel good. Not just look good, but I wanted them to feel good. And if I could get people around me that were passionate about that, that they loved that, they loved that idea of creating products that made people feel good. And beyond that, creating a products that could be a fashion for philanthropy, which gets us into our third core value of after Rob saying, I want to make sure that I'm going to do something good with my short time on this earth. And if we can create a successful company that also is making a positive impact on the world around us, that will be success, and getting people that felt that same way around it. So those three core values were my core values, and they became the company's core values. And what I realized is absolutely birds of a feather flock together. That is what has drawn people to this organization, that have drawn people to the brand as customers, because they too are customers. Have a heart that beats for their community. They love fashion. They love to feel good and look good, right? And they care immensely about their community and their family. And so they share it. And that's why we've created this incredible culture within the walls of Kendra Scott, but outside the walls of Kendra Scott as well.
Well, let me ask you, I'd love to dig in on the family part and try to play devil's advocate, because I've heard a lot of people, there's a lot of contentious discussions around whether people should talk about family in the business context. And I'll give you some of the arguments I've heard, and then I'd love to hear your counter arguments. I've heard a lot of people say, look, you should talk more like a team, because a team, you know, understands that we have these goals together, and, you know, the person is not scoring any baskets, then they're probably going to go on the bench. And I think some of the, and you might have a different way of handling this. I think families are not good at holding each other accountable. You know, oh, we the drunk uncle embarrassing everyone in the wedding. We brush that aside. So how do you hold that line when you have a family core value? I assume, you know, you have performance issues, you have to deal with stuff, and people say, oh, but I thought we were all family. That's the trap that I've seen a lot of leaders run into who try to adopt family as a core value, because I think a lot of people aren't good at holding the line with their family around things.
No, look, I mean, at the end of the day, I will hold my family accountable. I hold my children accountable. They have to go to school. They have to do their work. They have to do their homework. My boys have jobs. They pay for things. That is how I lead my life, right? And so I am going to give all of this understanding and leeway to be able to say, I want you to be present for your family at home first, because your work family is different, right? You have a family, a real family. Those are two separate things.
It's really about treating people with a family first mentality.
Exactly. And still saying, let's communicate on what are your needs to be able to do that. And how can I support you here in this business to be able to make sure that you're being present for your family, which I know is going to inevitably help you with your work here. When you're feeling balanced and you're feeling like I'm not letting my family down, I'm able to bring more into the office, into the workplace, right? But in addition to that, it's like, how do we also be kind and thoughtful to one another and say, if you're going through a hard time at home, if someone in your family is sick or someone is going, you know that you can come and we are going to support you through that. You are not alone in this. And this is a moment in time and we are going to be there for you. And I can promise you, when you treat your people with that type of love, respect, they will love and respect and work harder for you because you care about who they are and their happiness in their life. And they don't take that for granted. And I can tell you, to me, an empathetic leader is the most powerful leader in the world.
But with that said, it sounds like your definition of family has a lot of accountability, and you doesn't kind of stop you from calling people out who have demonstrated bad behavior on their point of view.
I'm lucky because I think I have the greatest team on the planet. So I have very rare those circumstances, quite honestly.
Maybe you screen very well for that.
We do. You should see the interview process people go through to become part of this group. But
what does that look like? I'm curious.
Yeah. We hear, again, you go through probably about 5 to 8 different interviews, minimum in some cases, depending on the role. Many times, and most times actually, we will have people, so even if you're in a leadership role, management director, vice president or above, the people that will work for you are the ones also interviewing you. So this is a collaborative decision on do we feel excited about this leader that is coming in to lead us? Because if they're excited and they're not just getting this push down, I believe in this pull up approach to how you hire people. You want to bring people in your organization that absolutely exemplify your core values every single day, that are these shining stars and lights. It does, and they could be an entry level position, but they have everything right, right? And you want to have those type of people interview, because they will smell out a rat in a minute. They sniff it out. And so we go through. So of course, you're going to also be meeting with your boss and you're going to be going through all these other things. But we are giving a very holistic approach to interviewing. And we want the actual real feedback, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think it's such a powerful tool, because then when we are hiring people, the people that are going through this are also seeing our culture and seeing it through a diverse background of people within the organization. And they get to understand, is this something that will be a good fit for me as well? We really want them to have that exposure, because we don't want it to be a mistake on either side, right? And so the more time that you spend in that process, because the worst thing you can do is like, we got to fill this position. We got to get this person. We're just all overloaded. Just hire, get it done. Yeah, they seem good enough. You are going to regret it.
There are a lot of organizations, and this actually is one of the things I think that came out of Silicon Valley that I like and that we've used, but they place a disinterested person in that hiring group for just this reason, to slow it down and make sure that I know this person's desperate and short-staffed, and to be the sort of company check and balance of not letting them kind of hire too early.
100%. You have to bring in cross-functional folks that will be interfacing with this person as well, because it's not just the person who's filling the position. It's how is this person going to interact with everybody else and collaborate on the team. And so it's such an important process. Take your time, slow it down, because the worst thing you have to do is get somebody on and then realize that it's not working out. Your team isn't happy. Now you've got to not only go through a firing process, which nobody likes, let's be honest. You have now lost your company so much more money and time, because now you're going back out to the search trying to retrain somebody. So take your time, slow down here and really get it right, and bring as many folks in your organization that you trust and know that they really have got it, to be another voice of reason, to get other perspectives and be open to those perspectives, even if you're desperate, desperate, desperate to get this position hired.
I know there are a lot of leaders that want to hire on values, core values. They're figuring out their core values. I just don't think they know how to, or haven't formed the right behavioral-based questions to test that. So without kind of blowing the interview process in general, could you just like give us a sneak peek? Like, how do you find out if someone is family first? What kind of question would you ask?
Well, I think, you know, one, most people that are coming in at this point to interview, they know the company culture, right? Like, they're going to know that. And we ask them, what has drawn you to Kendra Scott? What are the things about our company versus any of the other companies out there that excite you, or you're excited? And so we're not asking, tell us what you think about our family core value. You know, it's more like, what things about Kendra Scott have drawn you to want to apply for this position? And then then you start to hearing things, right? These are the things. I love that you guys are philanthropic. I love the work that you're doing in the community. You know, and I'm like, tell me, you know, are you involved? What things do you do? What, you know, tell me why that's important to you. And you start to form this conversation of understanding where they are and what they're about. If they're coming in and going, oh, I heard I can have a really flexible work schedule here, and I only have to come to the office once a week, or, you know, whatever, you're going to go, you know, that's not really the family value, right? The family value is different than that. So I think by, you know, giving questions that, one, aren't, you know, are you X, Y, and Z, and leading them, you are having to have more broad perspective of question to allow them to come in with their own feedback. And I think that is where you can start to have a conversation. And then the other big thing I tell my team all the time is, when you are in an interview, how is the person that you are interviewing making you feel? So forget about looking at their resume and going, oh, so I see you went to them. Who cares? I want to get to know them just like you're getting to know a friend at coffee, or you're meeting somebody for the first time. Get to know them. How do they make you feel? Is that person making you feel warm, happy? Do they have a positive energy about them? Do they feel like their glass overflowing? So what we do is we put attributes to what family things look like, what fashion, what philanthropy looks like. So we start to look for those attributes. And if that person's making you feel like, I don't want this conversation to end, I feel so good when I'm talking to this person. She's looking at me, she's listening to me. I feel cared for. I care responded to. That is a Kendra Scott person. That is the kind of person we want. If that person is making you feel like stressed at all, or your instincts are telling you like something's not right, she's saying all the right things, but I'm not feeling it. Listen to how you feel, not what they are just saying. Listen to how they're making you feel. And every time every single time that I have gone like, God, I really like her, but there was something, but I think it's okay. Maybe it was just me. Maybe I was off. I've regretted it.
I have shared a similar sentiment. I have a better negative filter, I think, than, you know, I made the wrong hires. But I think in the cases where I ignored I'm very good at the red flag. And because when I ignored it, there was something there, right? In terms of getting the wrong people versus the right people. So we talked a little bit about family. I hate the word work-life balance. I much prefer the concept of integration, because I think you're trying to make these pieces work together. Balance is not having your kid on your lap during a podcast while you're doing work. And I think if you have this goal of being in balance, you will constantly disappoint yourself if that looks like it has to be synchronous at any one time. So obviously you have, family's important, you're a parent. Like, what are your kind of core rules or lines for running a billion-dollar empire and being a engaged parent at the same time?
Have you ever seen The Wheel of Life? It is and you put out the pies, you make a circle and you cut the pies and you put, you know, health and wellness, spirituality, whatever things matter to you, money, career, family, da, da, da. And I do a once a month check in with myself. How does my wheel look? Is it turning nicely, or do I have a huge flat tire in my wheel? Is something completely, you know, shrunk down that I'm not doing? What small goals can I start to do to help refill that portion of my wheel so that my wheel will start to turn a little bit more cleanly. It's never perfect, but it's not as bumpy, right? And so like an example is I was like not working out anymore. I used to do yoga almost every day. It made my feel so great, but I was getting so busy. School got back up, trying to get the kids out the door. Like life had just gotten crazy. And I realized I'm just not feeling like myself. What is it? What is it that was happening? And I realized that was it. So I had to start to prioritize my day in, I have to set boundaries in that I'm able to do this however many times a week. I'm going to do this one thing, right? And I'm not going to try to do 50 different things. I'm going to do one thing. And then next month, like I look and I try to do something else, right? I feel very much that my family is a part of my business. My business is not, it's, you know, business is just part of our life, right? My kids have been involved and with me. And yes, they have sat on my lap at times in my office with me.
They have, but that's not your definition of good, right?
Right. It's not always what you want, for sure. But they know what I do. They see where I work. They understand what I do. I've brought them to certain things so they can see where mom goes during the day and some of the things I work on. I get their insights on things. And I think that that's been so good because we have these dialogues at dinner. Like they're asking me, like, what did I do about this? Or, hey, mom, how's that new brand coming? And I'm asking them, hey, what did the algebra test work out? Or what, you know, we have these great conversations and we set priorities of things that we know are non-negotiables. So what are your non-negotiables? For me,
that's what I was curious. Yeah.
Yes. My non-negotiables are I have dinner with my family every night. That is a non-negotiable. Now, occasionally, do I have to have a business dinner or something like that? Yes, that happens. But am I going to have those frequently? No. Maybe once or twice a month that I'm not going to be able to have dinner with my kids, I'm going to be like, okay, but I'm not doing it once a week. That's just not going to work for me. Two, I want to be able to pick my kid, my youngest, because it's my baby, up from school at least 3 days a week. Okay. I'm not saying I can do it every single day, but I could do it 3 days a week. So on those 3 days, I asked my assistant to schedule my day to where I can leave at 3:30 to be able to go pick up my son and go with him to his, you know, tennis practice or whatever he has so that I can spend that quality time with him. And so you have to start to put these non-negotiables in and then, and have a team around you that is supporting those things happening. So here's the same way with our employees. You know, they may be in a group and I say, understand the demographic of that group. So do you have working moms? What are some of their non-negotiables? What are the things that they definitely want to be part of in their family's life? Then you start to build your agenda for your team, what that looks like. So we know on Thursdays, Sue has to be wherever because her son's got, you know, soccer at 4 o'clock. So we are not going to schedule meetings on Thursdays after 4 o'clock so that Sue can make sure she's there for her kid. These are ways that each team can start to look at their demographic and figure out how they can help their team, their members of their team, be feeling that good, like, okay, I'm getting to do some of these things that matter. And then, like I said, you know, on those days that I am able to do that, after I put the kids to bed, you know, of course, am I back on email and checking things? But I've had that time of fulfillment and joy that has given me this breath to be present with them, then I'm like ready to get right back into it, you know, later on.
I think that's great advice. And I think everyone needs to figure out those bright lines. And I know my wife has called me out on them in the past when I tried to make an excuse around one of them. And she's like, this is a slippery slope. If you go in this direction, all the walls will fall. I think those are critically important.
And you have to put them out there so that you can be held accountable. So like I say, no more than 3 nights away from my family when I go on a business trip. And, you know, I've had a time when my husband's like, honey, 3 nights. No, you like, come on. How? And I'm like, you're right. You're right. I'm going to squeeze in 3 more meetings in these 2 days somehow, because you're right. We've made this promise to each other and our family that we're going to do that. And, you know, you just have to do that. You have to do it. Otherwise it will start to edge. There'll be an excuse. It'll be a thing. Then one thing leads to the next. And before you know it, you start feeling crazed and like not healthy and not good. And you don't understand and things, you just feel like you're dropping things and it's because you've allowed those non-negotiables to become negotiable.
Yeah, constraints are helpful. And look, mine was birthdays. I never missed a birthday. But one year I had this opportunity and I was like, oh, I'll fly home in the morning for his birthday. And she was like, I don't like this. and she was 100% right. And I canceled that thing. And until my kids went to college, I never missed a birthday. And I'm glad that I stayed with that. So, all right, last question for you. What's a personal or professional mistake that you learned the most from?
You know, I think when I started opening my own retail stores, I started looking at other brands and thinking, okay, well, I mean, I want to be in, you know, all these, you know, you look at where they were located and they were in Beverly Hills and they'd be in, you know, Las Vegas and in New York City. And so I'd opened my first store in Austin, lines around the block. People loved, understood it. I'd been in Texas for 8 years as a wholesale brand, donating to all these nonprofits. So I had all these supporters who loved the brand. We were incredibly successful. We opened Dallas, tiny little store, same thing. Texas just went nuts. The store was crushing it. And I'm like, I want to be in Beverly Hills. So, you know, I'm from Texas. I went to this street called Rodeo and I thought, well, that's where I need to be. It wasn't exactly, it was on the corner, but I got the address somehow. I don't know. The building itself was on Rodeo Drive. But I like to still call it Rodeo. And I opened a store there and it was a disaster. The rent was high. I didn't have a customer base built up in California. And I didn't have the luxury of making a mistake because I was funding the business 100% on my own. I had to sign personal guarantees on all of these leases. And it was such an eye-opener. And during that time, I was also opening a store in Plano, Texas. And people were like, Plano? Like, what's in Plano, Texas? And I'm like, we could see on our e-commerce that we had a huge customer base buying online in Plano. And I opened Plano, and Plano, 1,300 square foot store, did close to $8 million in revenue its first year. Plano Insano is what I called it. And I realized very quickly the big mistake. I don't need a vanity store. I need stores that make money. I need to go where my customers are. And if my customers, take your ego aside and go where my customer is and look at my data, know where they're coming through e-commerce, know where my wholesale business has been building up. When those two things align, that's where we look for our next opportunity for a store. And get out of like, I had to do, Kendra Scott had to be here or there. Go where your customer is. And fortunately, I only had that one store that gave me that big, and I had a nice landlord who helped me sublease it and get out of the lease and was a nice guy, thank God. But I learned from it and I'll never forget it. And so I've been really thoughtful and cautious. We now have 138 stores across the country and, you know, and we've been able to grow, you know, the business, you know, as we've started to balloon outside of Texas. And it's really, I think, a very important thing to get out of your own, what you think you have to do or should do. And like you said, the ego, drop that at the door and start to really focus on where you can have the most success and where your customer is. And remember that your brand or your business is yours solely and that you shouldn't try to act or be like somebody else, because if you're trying to do what they're doing, you've already failed. So you've got to do it your way. The right way is your way and use your unique fingerprint and not try to do somebody else's.
Sage advice that I'm sure can benefit many people who are listening. So Kendra, where can people learn more about you and your book? Obviously, they know where to find the jewelry, but where can they find more about you?
So you can get Born to Shine on anywhere that books are sold. It's actually super exciting. We have the paperback is coming out in mid-April, I believe April 16th. So you'll be able to get the paperback, which is really exciting. You can actually pre-order it now. And I have a additional chapter that you'll be able to download when you pre-order. So that's going to be super exciting. You can see us at Kendra Scott, the company, and at Official Kendra Scott, which is my personal page. So you can see all about my crazy family, all the animals that I've collected over the years and everything else. And then, of course, at Kendra Scott for Instagram, Twitter, and all the rest.
All right. Well, Kendra, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your story with our listeners. I know, I'm sure I got a ton out of it, so I know they did as well.
Thank you so much, Robert. I'm glad we could finally make this happen. So thanks for having me on today.
It was worth the wait. So to our listeners, thank you for tuning into the Elevate podcast today. We'll include links to Kendra, her book, and her information on the detailed episode page at robertglaser.com. Thank you again for your support. Until next time, keep elevating.
This episode is brought to you by the Yap Media Podcast Network. I'm Hala Taha, CEO of the award-winning digital media empire, Yap Media, and host of Yap Young and Profiting Podcast, a number one entrepreneurship and self-improvement podcast where you can listen, learn, and profit. On Young and Profiting Podcast, I interview the brightest minds in the world, and I turn their wisdom into actionable advice that you can use in your daily life. Each week, we dive into a new topic like the art of side hustles, how to level up your influence and persuasion, and goal setting. I interview A-list guests on Young and Profiting. I've got the best guests, like the world's number one negotiation expert, Chris Voss, Shark Damon John, serial entrepreneurs Alex and Layla Hormozi, and even movie stars like Matthew McConaughey. There's absolutely no fluff on my podcast, and that's on purpose. Every episode is jam-packed with advice that's going to push your life forward. I do my research, I get straight to the point, and I take things really seriously, which is why I'm known as the podcast princess and how I became one of the top podcasters in the world in less than 5 years. Young and Profiting Podcast is for all ages. Don't let the name fool you. It's an advanced show. As long as you want to learn and level up, you will be forever young. So join podcast royalty and subscribe to Young and Profiting Podcast, or Yap, like it's often called by my Yap fam, on Apple, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.